It is. It's still the same size.
There's more books.
I thought it might have grown.
There are more books around.
No, it's okay.
That makes it smaller.
It's making it smaller.
It does. So but tomorrow you have to
do something. Yeah, it's just start.
It's at 5 o'clock, isn't it?
I'll have to talk to you at some point about this Indian student who's desperate to come and study here. Niranjan Saha, or Saha Niranjan, from Chennai. I'll tell you about it. He's very eager to come, but yeah. I think he's been accepted by the theology faculty. All he needs is a pile of money to make it possible.
Why do you look at me?
Well, he keeps saying, if only you can talk to Dr. Morgan, she will make it possible. And I said, money is very difficult at Oxford. And, but I promised him.
I wonder why he thought that.
I think you were assigned to him, or he was assigned to you or something. Yeah. So he figured you must have great power.
Oh, I see. Okay. Get him assigned to somebody else.
I told him you were very kind, but it may not be possible for you to do anything for him. But I'll tell you.
Other than take him to dinner once a term or something.
Well,
yes, I think that's what that obligation usually seems to be to my colleagues.
So perhaps we should make a start. I'm very, very pleased indeed to welcome back Professor Frank Clooney, who's the Parkmore Professor of Divinity and Professor of Comparative Theology at Harvard. He was the academic director here for several years, and he's renowned and famous for his work on comparative theology and his many books and publications in that field. I won't go into a long list of what he's done, but I'm sure you all are familiar with his work. And today he's going to speak about comparative theology as theological practice, comparative theology as a theological practice. So Frank, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you.
There is a handout I'll pass around just to give you a guide to where I'm going with this. And I would like to begin by expressing my pleasure at being back here. Some of you I know, some of you I hope to meet after we're done here or while we talk. But it was a great thing for me to be part of this center for 3 years, 2002 to 2004, and to participate in many events in this room. And it's nice to be back for the first time in 3 years, so it's a great opportunity for me to be with you. I came, actually, I had heard about the splendid weather that England was having this year, record-breaking global warming sunshine, and I'm assuming it'll come back tomorrow. But I... happy to be here in every case. This topic that I have here, it's a reflection on the work I've been doing on Vedanta Deshika, who was a 14th century Sri Vaishnava, South Indian Hindu theologian, and his particular greatest work, the Srimad Rahasya Trayasaram. And as I'll explain in a moment, I'll reflect on it from a number of angles. But it's appropriate to be able to make this presentation here now, because when I was here first in 2002, I actually gave a seminar on the text. And that was really at the beginning of the two book projects that I'm finishing, hopefully, this summer. So there's a kind of way in which the project has gone around and hopefully coming to conclusion at this point. So really what I'll be sharing with you is reflections based on how I have thought about this text, read this text, studied this text over... really more than a five-year period, but certainly somewhat intensively over the past 5 years. And what I will try to do is briefly at first, because I know many of you would be familiar with this already, is tell you a little bit about the text, just to put it in context. And then basically the second side of the handout would be six different ways of thinking about how the text engages us and draws us in. And I would not say that all six levels are theological levels, but nonetheless, they do move into clearly theological and then what I would call comparative theological concerns. I'll try to keep my comments to a half hour, maybe maximum. Usually when I say that, I go longer than that, but not much more than that, because I very much like to interact with you and talk about these things. And the text itself, Srimad Rahasya Trayasaram, is for me the example. And by that I mean that it's the text that I have been working on, and it raises the questions that I will put before you now. But you may, by way of analogy, think that other texts that you have been reading, raise some similar questions or raise different questions that I'm not talking about. And so we can certainly discuss that as well. It doesn't have to be only about this particular text. I think you all know something about Sri Vaishnavism. Again, as I said, South Indian, Tamil, Sanskrit, Vaishnavism, rooted in the great cities of Kanchipuram and Sri Rangam, in particular Tirupati, in the current-day Andhra Pradesh, a tradition that calls itself and has called itself for 1,000 years or more the Ubhaya Vedanta, the double Vedanta, or a Vedanta with roots in both the Sanskrit and Tamil tradition, which is interesting for all kinds of reasons in terms of how the Sri Vaishnava community in Tamil Nadu thinks of itself as Brahmanical, as Sanskrit-based, as Vedic, very, very orthodox, but has insisted for a very long time that the Tamil tradition is equally relevant and has argued certainly well over 1,000 years that a total dedication to the Sanskrit tradition does not preclude paying attention to the vernacular. Of course, they wouldn't use the word vernacular in those days, but nonetheless that a non-Sanskrit-based language with a whole different literary history and feel to it is equally authoritative, and that what is said in Sanskrit is also said in Tamil, and the revelation is kind of a double revelation. And I think that is interesting for me, this whole idea of the double sources and the so-called Manipravala literature, which is the Sanskrit-Tamil literature, because it complicates the tradition and complicates a text like the Srimad Rahasya Trayasara, which is written in a mix of Sanskrit and Tamil. You really need to know both languages to read it. But also because they've been kind of self-consciously positioning themselves all this time. They didn't simply take up a Sanskrit tradition or a Tamil tradition and put themselves in that lineage. But right from the start, they were kind of arguing that they were like and unlike other orthodox thinkers, and that they needed to explain to others and to themselves to some extent, you know, where their authority came from, what their sources were, how they could justify using Sanskrit sources which make no reference to the Tamil, but then also drawing on the Tamil sources and so on. And I think it gives it kind of an extra dimension of self-criticism, self-awareness, self-exposition, that they've had to deal with two languages over many centuries. And that's interesting to me, finally, because in some ways I think it's like the situation we find ourselves in now in the 21st century, that whatever religious tradition we belong to, we should be, if we're paying attention, conscious of other religious traditions. And if we have a certain theology or orthodoxy to which we're committed, we have to be aware that there are other such traditions, other such orthodoxies around us, and in some way to reaffirm our own without excluding the other. And that's not always the same as what these thinkers are doing, but nonetheless it has certain analogies. The text itself is called Srimad Rahasya Trayasara. The word must be written there somewhere. It's at the very bottom of the page if you need to see the spelling. But the Rahasya Traya, as I have there at the top on that first page, are the three mantras. The three rahasya, secrets, sacred words, precious possessions of the tradition, both secret in the sense of not being readily available to everybody, that they do make them public, but don't believe that people are always ready for them, that there's a certain kind of sense of privacy about them in that sense, but also that rahasya is what is most precious to us. And that a long tradition before Vedanta Deshika, who lived, as you can see in the middle of the page, approximately 1268 to 1369, even before his time, there was a tradition that the three mantras of the tradition contained everything that needed to be said or could be said about the tradition. Now, obviously, that has to be taken in a, in the tradition of Indian commentary and in the Indian tradition of mantra. We're not literally, I mean, these are very short texts. Not literally everything that could be said is in them, but in some way when they are read properly, they open up all the metaphysical, the ontological, the philosophical, the psychological, the spiritual dimensions of what the tradition is about. And just as Christian theologians over the centuries have tried, let's say, to use the creed, the Nicene Creed or Apostles' Creed, as a kind of a reference point for explaining all the things that Christians believe and do, for the Sri Vaishnavas in South India, these three mantras basically became the place for explaining all that they believed and would do, and the realities that they were trying to practice and connect with. I don't think for the purpose of this definition I need to go through the three mantras in any detail, but you see them there, both the Sanskrit and the English, the Tudra mantra, Charma shloka, and Dvaya mantra. Before Vedanta Deshika, under number two, you can see that there were earlier commentaries on them. The first, perhaps, is this work, the Ashta Shloki of Parashara Bhattar, eight verses, four on the Tudra mantra, two on the Dvaya mantra, and two on the Charma shloka, very briefly trying to expound their meaning. Both the letters of them, like the Om, the A-U-M in English, the specific meanings that can be assigned to those syllables, and then also the meaning in these contexts of what does the word Narayana mean, why is the word Narayana in the dative case, Narayanaya, what is the Sarvadharman Parityajya in the Charma Shloka, when it says in the Dvaya Mantra, and this is really what I'll be talking about more tomorrow, when it says Shri Man Narayana, what is the relationship between Shri and Narayana? All of these things are spelled out very, very succinctly in Parashara Bhattar's text, at greater length in texts like the Parenta Rahasyapati of Pariyabachan Pillai, the famous Mumukshupati of Pillai Lokacharya. And there was kind of an established system before Vedanta Deshika of stylized kind of exposition of our beliefs, our practices, our goals in light of these three mantras. What is different about Vedanta Deshika is that he does it at great length and with kind of exhausting completeness. You might say exhaustive and exhausting completeness. It's hard to judge how long the text is because any edition of it I've seen always has ample notes. The English translation from the 1950s is about 500 pages. I have several versions with Tamil commentaries which are about 1,200 or 1,300 pages. The nice kind of critical edition of it that came out a few years ago is maybe about 1,100 pages, but it has ample notes. So it's a big text, and Vedanta Deshika tries to be thorough in terms of what he thinks the three mantras mean, but also in terms of taking into account whatever had been said before him by figures such as Parashara Bhattar, Pillai Lokacharya, and others. Not in a sense of trying to disprove them or kind of in a hostile sense of trying to do away with their positions, but very much trying to, I think in a constructive, friendly fashion, say all of what my predecessors have said can be harmonized in the following fashion. And so kind of a brilliant act of synthesis, which in details, later thinkers, like disciples of Pillai Lokacharya, criticized Vedanta Deshika and said he didn't get it right, and there were things that he missed or he overemphasized. That kind of thing would certainly happen. But one reason that Deshika's text is so long is that he's trying to put everything together. And sometimes he'll do, you know, here's what I think this syllable in the Tudra mantra means, and here are 10 other meanings that have been stated previously, all of which are acceptable in their own way. Occasionally he'll rule something out and say this is a totally wrong position, but usually it's this kind of inclusion and effort to bring things together instead of leaving them out. The second little chart on the page, I'm rushing through the first page because the second side is actually what I want to talk about. But I think you can see from this the kind of the logic of the text. The third and fourth columns are, in a sense, you might say, the core of the text. The third column, mantra, the mantra or the rahasya, the Tudra mantra, Dvaya mantra, Charma shloka, which are exegeted in three chapters, chapters 27, 28, 29. Three chapters which probably make up some 30 or 40% of the whole text. So big chapters. It's a 32 chapter text, but a very large part of it is given to this exegesis. I think the chapter on the Charma Shloka, the Gita verse, is almost 100 pages in various editions. So this is a very large part of the work is given over to this exegesis. But what is interesting for me, and this is really what he does that other earlier commentators did not do, are the first two columns. The first column would be more or less general, that the Tudra mantra really tells us the nature of reality. Om Namo Narayanaya, everything is for Narayana. All beings exist in relationship to Narayana, independence, for praise, and that humans, by reciting this mantra, affirm the basic nature of reality. The Dwaya mantra is taken as the Hitta mantra, doing what is beneficial, which is basically to take refuge at the feet of Narayana with Sri. If reality is such, as the Titta mantra tells you, then taking refuge, prapatti, radical surrender, is what one ought to do with one's life. And more or less, it's a little bit complicated with the Charma Shloka, but what is the end result or the goal of life? And I think for Vedanta Deshika, he takes different parts of this mantra differently, but basically it's the sense of giving up all self-dependence, all religious ritual as one's own way of salvation and so on, being freed by the Lord. Moksha ishyami, I will set you free. You do not set yourself free. You do not gain moksha. And therefore, ma suchaha, live without fear. And this kind of describes, you might say, the ethics of the text about how one lives one's life after taking this total act of surrender. But what he does, and you can see the second column finally, chapters 3 to 6, 7 to 12, and 13 to 19, are really expositions in narrative form that explain what the mantras are saying in their very concise fashion. And most of the other texts, including the ones I referred to in number 2, have no such narrative exposition put together in precisely this way. So it's clear that Vedanta Deshika wants to do the exegesis, but he also wants to spell out as clearly as possible the philosophical or ontological, the psychological, spiritual, and the ethical implications of the mantras. In smaller print, I have other sections which I need not go into here. For instance, the preface, the Guru Parampara Sara, is about the lineage of teachers with whom one must connect oneself if one is to understand and teach this properly. And I'll come back to that point later. The last two major chapters, 30 and 31, return to that theme, the duties of the acharya, the duties of the disciple. And he has a very strong sense that tradition exists in texts and in brilliant thinkers like himself, I suppose, but primarily through connection to the teachers who have gone before. And that if you learn this properly, you become in the position to pass it on to the next generation. And therefore, the lineage and the transmission is extremely important. And you know this from other traditions as well, I'm sure. And there are other chapters in there about disputed topics and so on. But I think the main point I'd like to make by this really fast little summary of the text, and we can come back to this if you have questions, is that it's an extremely comprehensive text. I think it is meant to be a complete exposition of the tradition, a kind of synthesis, and in the sense a text for prayer and meditation as well. There are Sanskrit and Tamil verses scattered through the text and always at the beginning and end of each chapter. And I think there's a way in which he's trying to give you the theology or the exposition, the exegesis, but also put it in a context where it begins to give you the right attitude of mind and heart. And that the text is meant to, therefore, bring about the state of devotion or surrender about which it speaks. So it's not simply an exposition of something that you can then practice somewhere else, but the text itself becomes a mediator of what it's talking about. And I think part of the reason he does it at such great length is to try to explain what it is like to enter the world of this text and to live according to it. The so-called Vadagalai Sri Vaishnavas, the northern school, it's all in Tamil Nadu, but the Vadagalai Sri Vaishnavas boast that after this text, nothing else of interest was said in their tradition, which most of us would not take as a great compliment. But they're very proud of the fact that after Vedanta Deshika, he was kind of the seal of the tradition. It had been said, it had been explained. Now, they write commentaries that go hundreds or thousands of pages, and I think those have not, barely been studied at all. But the conception is that he did this so famously and so well that this is who we are. And he has this very special place for the Vadagalai Sri Vaishnavas, not at all that place for the Tengalai, the other school, the southern school, who see him as a seriously flawed figure who messed many things up. But for his own tradition, this text was kind of normative, canonical, really, in terms of establishing everything. What I would like to do is, unfortunately, it's the last line on the first page, number 5, and then through number 10 on the second page, is now talk about 6 different ways that I've reflected on appropriating or having access to this text. where I have been drawn into it, what kinds of both academic and theological and spiritual issues come up in reading this text, and how I've kind of juggled these things. And this is really the part that I'm interested in what you think, because again, you may wonder about one or another of these, or you may have something to add that, you know, I've left out, whatever. But I've been doing this. I first read the English translation of this text probably about 1980 or so. And then more or less since I was here in 2002, I've been reading parts of it in the original with the commentaries over the past, you know, 5 years, 6 years, whatever. So I've spent a good bit of time with it. I mean, when I go to places like Sri Rangam, they'll point out, well, that's by no means enough time. And you started way too late in life, so this does not work properly. But nonetheless, they'll say, for a foreigner, not so bad. You did okay. But for me, it's a considerable commitment. And my reflection is that not only does it make me academically capable of talking about this text more than most Western scholars would be able to, but it raises more interesting intellectual issues and even personal issues, and then comparative issues with my own Christian tradition that I think I want to present to you. The first one at the bottom of the first page, reading to detect context, historical, cultural, religious. It's always a duty that we have, and for me it's usually a hard thing to do, is to try to put these texts in their context. And I think this is particularly a duty that any of us who claim to have some Indological learning or some commitment to Indian studies as an academic, historical, philological discipline, is that we can't just take a text and let it kind of float in space, but we need to somehow situate it in its time and place. The problem I find, and this is on the top of the second side, Vedanta Deshika is extremely reticent on his historical context. And in a sense, if he cared about the outside world, he hides it from us. I think it's true that you could read his entire text and find no reference in the hundreds of pages to anything that happened outside. Now, it doesn't mean that this is a timeless text and you couldn't tell if it's 1000 BCE or written yesterday or in 1400. You know, there are all kinds of clues that I think can be teased out about, you know, likely time period and so on. But he does not want his readers to be situating this in light of the events of history or social conditions or role of kings and royal families and so on. The most striking example of this I've found always is that by tradition, in the Sri Vaishnava tradition, 8, 10 years, 15, I forget how many years exactly, but fairly shortly before this text was completed, there was a major disruption in the pillaging of the Sri Rangam temple, the great temple that still exists today. Some kind of a Muslim army, I guess you'd have to call it that, I'm not sure what the technical term would be, but came in and pillaged the temple, destroyed many of the images, burnt things. I think Pillai Lokacharya, the other great acharya of this period, died while fleeing. He died of a heart attack or something because he was very old. Vedanta Deshika, by tradition, fled holding Sudarshana Suri's commentary on Ramanuja's Sri Bhashya and saved it from destruction by taking it with him. But they scattered, and the temple was destroyed, and some went to Melkote and other places to hide out for a period and then came back. You'd have no clue from this text that anything like that had ever happened. You know, I think we modern people would love to have, you know, reflection on that kind of thing and what happened and, you know, what did it mean for him, this tragic event, and why did this happen, and so on. Nothing is given. He refers any number of analogies in the text to, you know, this god acts like a king would act in the royal palace. And probably a good historian could pick out what kind of a palace is being talked about or what kind of a royal family is at stake and maybe do something on the history there. But he'll never give us a context. And therefore, while I think it's a great thing to look for the, you know, reading text in their historical context, I've seen very few good instances of that where it really pays off with classical texts. And with this one in particular, I haven't seen good examples of what kind of historical contextualization would actually make a difference. And perhaps we just don't know enough about how to deal with that. Again, somebody might want to jump in when I stop talking about, you know, some of the possibilities that go with this and things you might think of that would matter historically. One way to get at it is there analyzing his choice of citation, clearly he's telling us that certain texts were written before his time or composed before his time because he's quoting them. And clearly these texts have some kind of authority status, both in Sanskrit and Tamil. And he's using certain texts and not using other texts. So he quotes a lot from texts like the Lakshmi Tantra. I think he quotes from the Bhagavata Purana maybe once or something. I mean, what does that tell us about? It doesn't mean that it wasn't written in his time. It just means that it was not his text. The Vishnu Purana he quotes all over the place. Ramayana he quotes. Mahabharata he quotes frequently. Clearly the Upanishads were written before his time, or composed before his time, but he almost never cites them in this text. And one view that scholars have is that this text is for everyone. This is not for initiated male Brahmins, and therefore the Upanishads, which would be seen as for a more elite group, he doesn't use. He uses common sources that anybody could quote and use. So you could do some work on putting him in context, if not his actual historical social context, something at least of the literary context, something of the knowledge that he brings of what kinds of Tamil and Sanskrit sources, and that would be valuable to do. There are certain places in the text I don't mention here where he argues about caste and the meaning of caste. There are those who say that because of bhakti or prapatti, caste is now meaningless, and there is no need for caste in our community. And he says this is a totally incorrect view, and we need to keep the hierarchies of caste because that is how we are kind of physically built. That's the prakriti or the nature of things. Spiritually, he says, everyone is equal, and any kind of distinction or prejudice based on caste is unacceptable. But he's very strong about keeping the hierarchies of the social order and so on. Now, more research can be done to talk about, well, is he arguing with Pillai Lokacharya, his predecessor? I've not found quite the arguments he's taking up in Pillai Lokacharya. But if there were kind of a certain fluidity in the 13th, 14th century about caste issues, well, that's interesting. At one place he talks about, you know, we're all equal, but there are those who say that this means that we should intermarry and eat together. And he says, no, it doesn't mean that. It can't mean that. So what kinds of patterns were there of social relationship in his time period? That kind of thing could be spelled out. But I think that kind of thing can only get us so far, and that's why it's only my first point. My second one there, or number six, reading inside the Rahasya Trayasara. What I've found over the years in reading this text is that it is a text that wants to draw you into its context. As I mentioned before, he's not simply giving you information about the three mantras or the ontology or philosophy of Sri Vaishnavism, but it's meant to be a text through its prose, through its poetry, through its citations, through the strong claims he makes, through the beauty of his analogies and so on, through pushing endlessly upon the reader the value of prapatti as radical surrender. All of these things seem to be calculated that if somebody actually reads this text over a period of time from beginning to end, and I had Sri Vaishnava Acharyas in India tell me, you have to do this three times, beginning to end, with the commentaries, with your teacher, before you get it. So that's a big commitment. But that it's the kind of text that if it draws you in, it changes the way you think. And if it changes the way you think, you have new memories, new options available to you, new ways of viewing both Indian and Brahmanical and Hindu materials, Tamil materials, Sanskrit materials, but also whatever reader you are, it forces you to think about things that you may not have thought about before and tries to touch your heart as well. And I think for me, it's not really possible to, as I suspect for most of us here, to make a sharp divide between the intellectual study of something and ways in which it might impact your personal life or your dispositions, your affections, and so on. And clearly he wants there to be an overflow from one to the other. I mean, he's always against people who have hard hearts or wrong desires and people who think improperly. And I think all of this is important to him. It's not soft on any side of this issue. But the whole impact of it is to draw you in and to, as I say, transform you in mind, word, and body. And therefore, as I say, there's a kind of education in submission, in relation to submission to the text. It changes you, or it can change you. And for me, this is an issue that just as on a certain Indological level, you have to decide how seriously do you want to find the context for what he writes, temple inscriptions and other texts and so on, historically. an issue, I think, for anyone reading a text like this, and you can think of other such texts, how much do you want it to have an influence on the way you live your life? And one answer can be, not at all, I'm just writing a book. Another can be, this is my religion, this is my path, and of course I will totally give myself to it. My argument is that if you're a scholar who takes it up for good scholarly reasons of Indology or comparison, it has the effect on you whether you like it or not, and you have to decide what to do about that. You can deny it, you can obscure it, you can pick and choose, that's fine. You can go wholehearted with it and in a sense become a disciple of this text and its master. But there are all kinds of choices to be made, and I think no scholar, I find, is in the position of saying, I didn't have to make any choices because there were no issues related to this. It gives you the opportunities, it changes you, and therefore you do have, you're required to make choices about whether this gets inside you or not. I put there the price of knowing Rahasya. These are, again, sacred mantras, not in the sense of being, you know, only whispered from ear to mouth to ear kind of thing, because you can reconstruct them easily from this text, what all the words are. But the price of it is, for someone like Vedanta Deshika, is that this is the knowledge that you should not trivially have, or you should not imagine yourself knowing this and then moving on. And I think in part of it, I found the impact is that the mantras are so short that I, who can remember almost no Sanskrit, am always jealous of people who can roll off endless shlokas. These three, in my own way, I've remembered and I can recite them. And I think the point of that is that the Sanskrit gets inside you. I mean, the Sanskrit becomes something that subconsciously or consciously is with you. And if you've read the text, then the words themselves become emblematic of the larger realities of which it speaks. So, you know, maybe there are pundits in India who could memorize all 500 pages of his text or something like that. I'm sure there are. Even if most people cannot, knowing by heart the three mantras themselves, in a sense, connects you to all of that. And if it connects you to all of that, then by belief in this tradition, it therefore impinges on your reality, your way of living your life, your sense of where you're going with your life, and so on. And, you know, I find that raises all kinds of interesting comparative questions and interreligious questions as well. But I'll come back to that in a moment. Number seven, in a sense more of the same, in a sense something additional, entering the commentarial context, reading the Rahasya Trayasara inside its context, tradition, reading with the tradition that came after this. So I mentioned before Sri Vaishnavas being very proud of the fact that there was no original thinking in Sri Vaishnavism after this text, which probably, again, may not quite be true. But there is a long commentarial tradition, and I have like five or six complete commentaries on this text, including one that was started in the 1990s. I'm not sure if it's ever going to be finished. I kept asking people in Madras, Chennai, who said, oh, of course it'll be finished. You know, the Acharya is like, you know, 100 years old or something, but they have no doubt about him finishing it. But there's a long kind of commentarial tradition going back to closer to the time of Vedanta Deshika and through the centuries. And I think this is not, and again, I think most of you know this, it's not to be taken for granted or trivialized or said, you know, that's an interesting but unimportant fact, but rather that the... as Vedanta Deshika himself says in his preface and then in chapters 30, 31, the tradition lives on in the transmission. And I think many of these commentaries were the teaching of the text over the generations, and perhaps the most successful teachings within the written commentaries. They were recorded. They didn't have tape recorders in those days, but they recorded them, and they became the written form of the teaching, which then could be read by others and then, you know, included in further expositions of the text and so on. So there's this kind of interplay between the text itself, the oral exposition of it to a new generation, and then how that sometimes becomes embodied in written word and printed word then afterwards. And again, I think this is obvious to you mostly, I would think. We need to resist the temptation to read solely on our own. And I think there can be an Indological Orientalist interpretation or tendency to read the original text by itself with disregard for the tradition that follows from it. much of this comes out of the Christian tradition, I think, where after the Reformation, after Martin Luther, John Calvin, and so on, there was a great frustration with the heavily invested Catholic tradition of the Middle Ages, and a desire to go back to the Word of God itself. And so, Luther translating the Bible into German, and so on. Everybody should go back and have the immediacy of the Word, and you don't need what all these popes and theologians thought during the centuries. In some sense, that is perfectly legitimate and important to go back to the original and read it for its own sake. But I think there can be a great mistake involved if somehow, therefore, nothing that came after it matters. And particularly not being Indian, not being Hindu, not being Sri Vaishnava, I've always been particularly interested that in reading a text like this, I want to read it with the tradition and not apart from it. And as a general principle in my research, I try never to work on a Hindu text that does not have a commentary, because I want to have some guidance, at least in terms of reading it inside the tradition. And if you do this with a text like this, thinking of Deshika himself as a commentator, using older sources, quoting them, and so on, in a sense, you become part of the tradition in some way. Because if you read the original and you read the quoted passages and then you read the commentaries on it over a period of time, whether or not you're kind of born in the tradition or initiated in it or whatever, there's a way in which intellectually you have kind of an engagement in it or a commitment to it that I think would not be possible to simply dismiss as saying, well, that's just reading books. Because you begin to think with the tradition. And while there may be some Sri Vaishnavas who say, well, if you're not born in a Sri Vaishnava body, then you're not one of us. And I think there are such people. I think from my perspective that there's a lot of gray area in the middle between being the outsider and the insider. And that reading with the commentarial tradition and then being consciously of writing with the commentarial tradition. So when I write about this text, in a sense, in some way, in English, I am extending it to an unanticipated language, unanticipated audience, and so on. And that's an issue maybe more for Sri Vaishnavas than for me. What is the status of this writing? And if they say, well, that's just what Western professors do, that, I would like to think, is not adequate to the reality. If somebody thinks about these things, reads them, takes advantage of learning from them. But is it in the tradition or out of it, I think raises issues about where does one engage and what does the engagement mean, and what to think of people who read from outside the tradition into it. Which leads to number 8 directly, reading the text and encountering the living tradition or the living community. My starting point in academe was in secondary school, learning Latin and Greek. Jesuit school, we had to learn Latin and Greek. And the great model was that we could, spend our time reading Homer and Hesiod and, Aeschylus and Euripides and so on, and then Virgil and Catullus and Horace and so on. And conveniently, they're all dead and their traditions are dead long ago, and luckily we don't have to kind of muck around talking to anyone who represents those traditions because they're safely embedded in classical times. And the joke always was that if any of the great, scholars of Latin and Greek literature, like here at Oxford, actually met ancient Romans or Greeks, they may have been horrified about, their personal habits and what they thought the poetry meant and so on. So there's this kind of sense of, I'm such a brilliant scholar, I've never met the people who have written these texts, or I'm a great Indologist who never goes to India. I mean, there is that tendency, caricaturing it, but a way in which meeting modern representatives of the tradition will just mess things up, so better not to, and stay away from them. Obviously, I don't think that, and I presume you don't think that when the opportunity presents itself to be in some kind of engagement with the members of the tradition today, whether or not the members of the tradition today have actually taken the time to study these texts carefully, and some have and many haven't. I always have people telling me in India, oh, you've spent all your time reading these texts and I haven't read them myself, and you know these things better than I do. But that's true and untrue. It depends on what level you mean by knowing these things for people. But I think it raises the issue of just raising about what does a Sri Vaishnava think of the scholar from outside the tradition who seems to have read much of this and read commentaries that no one else reads and then understands many of these things. is it possible to place that person as simply an outsider, or is that person now inside in some way? And then does that scholar want to be recognized as being in some way a member of the tradition or not? I try to, you know, keep a balance and have a strong sense of Roman Catholic identity as who I am. But it seems to me I would be misunderstanding what I'm doing if I said, well, that 100% excludes participation in the Sri Vaishnava tradition or its current community. And so I always have these very ambiguous relationships with professors and pundits in Tamil Nadu when I meet them, including on a trip from mid-February to early April this year, because they don't really know what to make of me. And I think that's a good thing. You know, do you want to be one of us or not? Well, it's too bad because you weren't born in the right body, so you're not one of us. Or maybe you are one of us and you should just become a Sri Vaishnava. Or, well, you know many things, but you don't know them properly because you didn't study with a teacher. I had a seminar when I was there on my previous book on Hindu goddesses and the Virgin Mary, and there were three pundits on three chapters of it, and the one on the Saundarya Lahari, the text attributed to Shankaracharya, the pundit said, oh, this is wonderful, you've done such hard work, this is so impressive, it's edifying that you, the foreigner, would do all of this. Of course, it's a complete failure. you've gained nothing from doing this because you didn't have an initiated teacher like myself. I think that's what he meant. But there's nothing could come from this because the words do not communicate. You have to have somebody to open their secrets. And right in my book, which I think he did not read carefully, I say that, of course, there are levels of engagement and possibility that come if you read with the teacher. And if you totally devote yourself to that relationship, then it's a powerful thing. But I think, personally, I think it's also foolish, and I'd be curious what you think, to somehow dismiss the power of the written word. And this may be a Christian disposition or a Jewish, Christian, Muslim disposition about the power of the written word, is not nothing. And that these words were composed by teachers like Vedanta Deshika. The mantras were crystallized into particular words by older representatives of the tradition. That the words themselves have a potency and that reading the words can be a religious act. And if reading the words is a religious act, then in some way it becomes hard to totally exclude somebody who's not done it in the way we expect. Now, Vedanta Deshika himself does say at the end of the Rahasya Triasar, I think 30 or 31, you cannot get knowledge of the mantras by reading, he didn't say books, I think like reading Palmyra skulls or something, the palm leaf inscribed text. You can get nothing from this. It's like hiding behind a wall and listening when the teacher is teaching someone. It doesn't count because you don't actually get anything from overhearing the other. And I think, to some extent, it's that's what Vedanta Deshika thinks. But it's also ironic, therefore, that he wrote this very long text, which then could be copied, transmitted, commented on. And if I was serious about the uselessness of writing and uselessness of books, I wouldn't have been Vedanta Deshika composing this text. I mean, if you want it to be oral, then keep it oral. If you think written words have no value, then don't use written words. But if you do, and the Sri Vaishnavas are famous for publishing books, they publish over and over again new editions of this and that, and even the ones who didn't weren't sure about me were always willing to sell me these books. And I think then are shocked that I actually read them. Oh, God, what do we do about that? And so all of this opens up an area of conversation about learning insider-outsider status, mixed messages about, the insider's looking at the outsider looking at the insider, and then different kinds of outsiders. The outsider who comes simply as a neutral scholar, professor so-and-so. The outsider who comes as a scholar like myself, but also says, well, I'm a practicing Catholic priest, etc. And the range of others. And then if it was an Indian Christian reading, I think that would be taken differently because you're an Indian then. If somebody was a convert, from Sri Vaishnavism to Christianity, that would be another category. So there are all these different relations, and I found the people I met, ranging from university professors in Madras to several pundits in Sri Rangam, a lot of what we were dealing with was really figuring out who we were. I think I may have had a clearer idea of who they were than they had of who I was, and that's fair enough, because I was thinking about them much more than they were thinking about me. And some of them, I think, you know, basically said, oh, that's who you are, so I don't want to talk to you. And that was the end of it. And others seemed to become more intrigued and said, well, there's something in, you know, that can't be ignored about the fact that you've done all this research. And several of them were willing to read some of my papers and said, well, there's something here that we cannot simply ignore. But then, who are you or what is this for? I think was an interesting issue. 9 and 10, and then I'll be done. I'm sorry, it is taking more than the half hour, I promise, but are related to the two books that I'm finishing, hopefully, by September. Number 9 is a kind of an explicit comparative study that the tentative title at the moment is Beyond Compare, a Hindu-Christian insight into radical surrender, which would be Vedanta Deshika's notion of prapatti. Basically on the premise that if one begins somewhere else, as I have, and many of us, I think, have, you know, we study things that we did not grow up with, and we study things that from somebody else's tradition, perhaps. We bring to the reading of the text unanticipated resources that the writers of the text and the tradition of the text never could have imagined, or could have imagined, but probably didn't imagine. So, you know, and this could be documented in terms of, well, what does a modern scholar in America visiting India, what does that kind of scholar know if he or she has a PhD in South Asian studies in the year 2000? What kinds of books have you read? And it's not just going to be Sri Vaishnava books or Christian books, but an enormous range of things that come to bear on how we think about religion, how we think about one religion or another, how we think about studying texts, all the stuff that goes with grad school and so on. All of these things come into play. But then if you're a member of a religious tradition, then you bring some of the expectations of that tradition to bear on what you study. And so, as I said before, maybe there's something very Christian about having this great emphasis on the written word or the power of the written word. And the oral is not necessarily better than the written. That could be something I bring because of the biblical tradition or the Catholic Church. I mean, it could be. And this would be a factor that I need to pay attention to, and that surely influences how I read the text. And I think in my view, any scholar who would simply say, I'm simply studying this text for objective reasons, is probably fooling himself or herself, that there are all these levels of bias, good or bad, indifferent, whatever, but there are things that affect how we read that getting back to the original in its original sense is probably impossible. And we read from where we are. So in many of my writings, but in this one too, I've tried to make that explicit by bringing in a Christian text explicitly into the discussion. I won't talk about this now, but after a trial and search effort, I've come up with this text around 1700. St. Francis de Sales, a doctor of the Catholic Church, wrote this book called Treatise on the Love of God, which is a great classic of Christian spirituality. A massive book. The French is like 500-600 pages, also a large thing. But it goes through love in its many levels, from physical desire to moral affection to the final levels of love of God, leading toward the end of the book to this sense of radical abandonment into the hands of God. And that love is ultimately so much that you are so given over to the other that you are like Jesus on the cross, who gives himself entirely into the hands of God, and in a sense, to be is to be given into the other. And I think, well, that, you know, it's not possible to document that and say, well, that's the same as prapatti, or radical surrender in Deshika's tradition. It has an interesting parallelism, at least, and it has an interesting kind of resonance with the Sri Vaishnava tradition out of a Catholic, biblical, 18th, late 17th, early 18th century French context of spirituality. I mean, there are a lot of things going on with it, but it seems that the power of that text and the power of Deshika's text can interact with each other fruitfully. Now, some scholars would have stopped at this point and said, well, this is sheer nonsense. This should not be done. And unless you can show that some historical connection, like Francis de Sales read Vedanta Deshika, this is just, you're playing a game. This is not meaningful. It's just an endless, pointless comparison. And I've had people say that to me in various polite ways. But my point is that you kind of retrieve from your inner, your memory bank, things that you know from many years, and you bring it to bear in terms of an example. So I'm reading Vedanta Deshika when I could have read thousands of other such texts for other purposes, and I'm reading one Christian Catholic text, and I'm saying, well, let's think about these together. And putting the book together, really, to summarize that briefly, I mean, it's really about the dynamics of this kind of complicated new reading. You know, what is it like to read a classic of spirituality in your own tradition? For me, Roman Catholic reading Francis de Sales, but what is it like for a Hindu or a Sri Vaishnava to read Vedanta Deshika? There are certain things you may learn an enormous amount, but it's kind of unfamiliar ground in some way, and you sort of feel that you're in the boundaries of what your tradition is about. And a lot of what I've been talking about is the second dynamic of reading from one tradition into another. And I would love to find some Sri Vaishnava who's reading Francis de Sales, but I've yet to find one. If you know any, send them to me. What is it like for me to read Vedanta Deshika, knowing the kind of spirituality and theology that Francis de Sales represents? What is it, you know, to in your own tradition, you kind of give it a green light and you go with it and say yes, even if you don't, it may not be to your taste, a sort of 18th century piety or whatever, but you can say yes to it basically. Saying yes to the other tradition is more complicated unless you want to join that tradition. Many Christians believe conversion is possible. Many Hindus don't believe conversion is possible. You know all that. And so what happens when you engage the other as you engage your own? So I'm reading Vedanta Deshika like I'm reading Francis de Sales. Do I put on an orange light or a red light at a certain point and say, well, at this point I must stop? And where do you stop and how do you make choices about, I don't want to learn any more from this tradition? That kind of thing. And then thirdly, what happens when you read them together? Because I think I may be the only person in the past or future to read these two texts together, except if somebody reads my book and is inspired by it. But, you know, it is in a sense, in a good sense, arbitrary, taking these two figures. But neither one nor the tradition of neither of them anticipates reading the other. And both Vedanta Deshika and Francis de Sales are kind of worlds unto themselves, complete traditions, religious traditions, spiritual, theological traditions, and basically saying, this is enough. This is enough for this lifetime. And reading them together, in a sense, violates both of them by saying, I'm going to read your complete worldview with another worldview. And that can be destructive, obviously, but it also can intensify the powers of each, and I think that's the case. But the general point was that for any scholar or person who would, you know, seriously study a text of another tradition, what are you bringing to that reading from your own tradition? And then what happens if you make that explicit? And then finally, number 10, and then I'll stop, Christian commentary, Christian reading, Christian commentary, the other book I'm doing, which is for a little series that's just getting started of Christian commentary on non-Christian texts. The first volume is out. You may have seen 10 essays by Christians on the Bhagavad Gita. I can probably get you a copy for the library at some point, but that was kind of a sample volume, and now there are multiple volumes being written at this point. But I decided, because I'm a friend of the editor, Catherine Corneal, who taught at Louvain previously, teaches in Boston now.
I knew her in that lifetime.
Okay.
Yeah. Have an academic exchange.
Okay. Oh, we'll have to talk about that. Yeah. So she's editing this series, and as a favor of her, I said I'd write something. Originally, I was thinking of writing a Christian commentary on the Rahasya Trayasara of Vedanta Deshika, and realized, you know, it would be like 3,000 pages or something by the time I was done. So that was too big for the profile of the series. So I said, all right, I'll do as Vedanta Deshika did and write a Christian commentary on the Rahasya Traya, the three mantras. Which, again, some people would say, no, you can't do that because you have to be of the tradition. This has to be your Rahasya to do this. But in some sense, in fact, each chapter, like 70% of the chapter, is Vedanta Deshika. What does he say about it? Because I don't see the point of writing a Christian commentary if you haven't done a proper just commentary. And so he's my guide. But then trying to bring it explicitly into some kind of connection with Christian prayer, Christian spirituality, Christian devotion, arguing that while this need not be done, there can in fact be an informed view of the three mantras from outside the Sri Vaishnava tradition, and that it needn't be a polemic or it needn't be kind of a bland pluralism either, but this kind of thoughtful engagement commentary. Now, some people might say by definition it's not a real commentary because commentaries are in tradition, not from outside tradition. But I think in light of all the other ambiguities I've been talking about, kind of Christian commentary on a Sri Vaishnava text is, it goes from Sri Vaishnava to Christian. And there's a way in which there's a continuity and not a radical break between the two. So all of this is, for me, just giving you examples of the many kinds of things I've been thinking about around reading this text over the past 5-6 years. And that none of these questions can be simply excluded or denied that they exist. Obviously, no one has to take up all these questions, but if anyone would stop and say, well, all I'm doing is an Indological study, number 5, and a Historical study, number 5, perhaps, and the other questions simply are not real questions, I think they're missing the boat in terms of what scholarship is or should be. And if you follow it through, there's no reason to leave out 9 and 10, where you make some more conscious, explicit reference to the spiritual, theological tradition to which you belong. So on that note, I'll stop. Thank you. Much longer than I said it would be, but anyway.
Well, thank you, Frank. That was a real tour de force. It was incredibly stimulating. Ideas were coming out there that are going to take a while to kind of sink in, I think. But let me open the floor to discussion first while I have a think.
So those of you who can speak without thinking, go first.
I'll do that. Instead of shock.
Have you ever been seen by members of the tradition as a friend of the
It's probably more the case. I'm very sensitive to these issues, and I think at some point, you know, if I meet a really traditional acharya or pundit, clearly that I'm not in any way what that person would expect. Clearly, I've met a few people who, or tried to meet a few people who said, no, we don't talk to such people as me. I've been criticized, like 2 years ago when I was in India, by the local RSS in Tamil Nadu, which, because it's a hot climate, they're much more lethargic than the RSS in general. But they were criticized and say this is kind of basically a hidden missionary effort, and Clooney is out actually to destroy us, not to be our friend. But all of that's the exception. And maybe I'm overstressing that, because I'd say most of the time, you know, I've been well-received, welcomed. I don't live in India, so, you know, I'm not with these people all the time, but people do seem to be appreciative of what I do. They welcome me in most temples, not like Sri Rangam, but most temples I'm welcome in. When I was there this time, again, as in the past, the Vaishnava department at the University of Madras asked me to give a lecture, this time simply on the Charma Shloka. And maybe 200 Vaishnavas came, mostly Tengalai, that tradition, but both. And they seemed to be totally happy with everything I said, and this all seemed to be, you know, they were so happy that I was doing this, and they all, you know, gave me things to read and so on. So it basically is a positive experience. But with, you know, some people, and maybe rightly thoughtful, saying, well, you know, what do you think you're doing, or why are you doing this, and drawing questions. But the anything that's really hostile or, you know, cold, it would be a smaller minority in terms of the general experience I've had.
I mean, built into that is the fact that you live with one lives with a history of attempts to conversion.
Mm.
And do you ever have the opportunity to talk about that and how that would be something that has changed, that you are personally uncomfortable with, or that many Jesuits haven't been like that,
yeah,
even in the past, let alone now? I mean, is there a possibility for engagement on that? Because, you know, one comes with baggage as a Christian in a place like,
yeah,
India.
I try to. I try to talk about changes in the Catholic Church, or changes in the way these things are thought about. Most of the people I'll be talking to about this have very little knowledge of anything after the Bible, if anything. I mean, so they don't really know usually a lot about Christian tradition or history, or even clear distinction between Catholic and Protestant often is not there. And what I don't want to do in that context is simply say, well, you know, I'm actually very liberal and I'd like to repudiate the tradition, because I don't think that's helpful. Mm-hmm. But try to make distinctions about how these things have been dealt with, and how changes in Christian thinking have moved many Christians, including me, away from efforts to convert people, and that is a new phenomenon. They'll go back sometimes and say, you know, well, if we go back, and some things I published they can read, reading like someone like Robert de Nobili, who was the Jesuit in South India, 1600 and thereafter. Some of his writings are clearly polemic. I mean, although he dressed like a sannyasi and so on, his goal was to convert. And they'll say, you know, learning Sanskrit or Tamil doesn't mean that you're on our side. But I do try to differentiate things. And many of these people know Jesuits in South India. But still, I think for some who you know, I might have met for the first time, there's an ambiguity about the history that the, you know, the missionary or the priest or the Jesuit represents. And that's what, you know, I don't know about. If I came simply as a American professor, would that be better or worse? I don't know.
It's a double whammy, really. Being white, suspected colonialist, even if you're American, not British, yeah. Westerner, and then a Christian. there's a double whammy. So being, it might not even, if you assume being Christian, but that there's a complete...
Yeah.
How would you define reading? Because, I mean, that's a kind of a technical word. Mm. And I guess it's also practice. You use it just not as an intellectual cognitive process, but also as a practice. So how would you define reading? Because that's the key word in your presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
Reading together text, reading one to the other, many levels of reading, and so on. So how exactly would you present the reading, the act of reading?
That's a hard point. And we have a dictionary here. What does the word reading mean? My first work in Indian studies was Purva Mimamsa.
Thinking ritually,
yeah. And the Mimamsakas have, in some sense, I'm not sure what their definition of reading or swadhyaya would be or something, but this commitment to the kind of building blocks of understanding from, you know, word meanings, grammatical forms, to vakyas or sentence meanings, to prakarana, context, and then always the like the shabdartha in connection to the kriyartha, the ritual implications of this, the samkalpa of the you know, the yajamana in terms of how this is read and performed for the sake of what pala at the end. And I think in my sense of reading, which is a wonderful thing that I should say more, you know, have something better to say about, but that it's this complex, multi-level kind of engagement in the other, in which one does build from, you know, the grammatical and the contextual to richer levels of implication.
So, would you consider that as more a spiritual act than as a cognitive act, or is it still in a cognitive? If at all, it is still in a cognitive level. How would you qualify it as a spiritual practice?
Well, I would say, both in the, you know, the classic Christian tradition and in many of the Hindu traditions, there's some kind of a continuity from intellectual analysis and the simple basic knowledge of what words mean and so on, to an understanding of what they mean, and then a feeling of the moral spiritual force of where that would lead one. So, you know, again, the Mimamsakas would say, if you say swarga kamo yajeta, and if you don't know any Sanskrit, well, that doesn't do anything for you. But if you understand, you know, those who desire heaven, let him sacrifice or let them sacrifice, then suddenly you realize that there's a, you know, a possible injunction upon you to do something with this. Analogously, in other fields, that the intellectual understanding, I personally would say, you know, it stops being intellectual and then becomes spiritual, but it moves from one into the other. If one is reading a text like this, now if you're reading a chemistry book, it might lead to laboratory experiments, but it wouldn't have to become spiritual. But the intention of these authors, if you engage the text properly, would I think bring out this. I don't know if that helps.
Shonika?
Yeah, you're obviously conscious, because you said it there, of the tension with academia as it stands. So scholars as it stands, they read a book, they go to a library, lock the door, make sure the tradition is elsewhere so that they can...
I always lock my door too.
so they can really, really get the point. You know, but as you say, you're engaging with, you know, so how you're reading is very interesting, because you're engaging with the commentary and with the interpretations, and you're very interested in that to inform your reading. So you are involved yourself. That's your question. You're questioning that openly. Now how important do you see it that scholarship in some of its forms has to pursue that? I mean, maybe not in chemistry, but in this kind of regard, because you're charging ahead. You know, I'm just looking at the titles of your two new books, and you know the 10 commentators on the Bhagavad Gita, just 10 new commentators on the Leviticus. That'd be
yeah, and serve the right.
it'll just be so long before that happens. But I'm interested that so you are charging ahead, but how important do you see, or is it inevitable that scholarship has to go that way?
I mean, I would always try to distinguish between kind of a claim about the way things should be done from the actual agenda for any particular scholar, because I think it's possible to say, you know, given the things I need to do and given my concerns and so on, I'm just not going to ever do that. So somebody could say, well, you really should spend a year at Sri Rangam and know the life of the ritual life of the community so that you can understand this text. And I perfectly agree with that, but I'm never going to do that. So I wouldn't say that everybody has to do all of this, but I do think kind of for us as a scholarly community, people who are interested in religious traditions such as this one, there's something seriously wrong with the kind of scholarship if the necessary Indological work, philological work, historical work, which often are correctives to romantic misunderstandings and sloppy thinking about traditions, if that kind of work, if somebody claims, well, that's all there is. I think it's a real blessing to have professors who can, you know, do really, you might say, hardcore Indological study and philological mastery of the grammar and reading of inscriptions and so on. All that seems to need to be done. But I don't see any reason to think that we or any such scholar could claim credibly that that's it, or that's all that can be done. I think it's not fair to the traditions that are being studied, and it's not fair to how we read to draw such lines. So I would think, part of it, I'm always dealing with the Christian tradition too, and I think like in the Roman Catholic tradition, after years of resisting biblical scholarship, particularly from the 1940s on, applying historical critical methods to the study of the Bible and trying to get at the latest exegesis of, you know, how to read the Exodus story of the crossing of the Red Sea properly and how to demythologize the Gospels and so on. I think what happened by the 1970s was to say that needed to be done because there was all this kind of stuff built up, you know, blurring what we think these texts are about and so on. A lot of it's just piety, and it was all ill thought and bad habits over generations. But I think the people then also realized that, well, that's not enough. You can't just go back and say, well, maybe in 700 BCE so-and-so was writing in such a way so that the crossing of the Red Sea probably had such and such a meaning for somebody back then. Because in fact, both the Jewish and Christian traditions still see power in that story and believe that the reader of that, you know, will be touched by it. And so we have to, you know, the Christian scholars have found the need to make room for further developments and kind of regaining back the fuller, richer picture after the kind of restorative work has been done. And I think in Indian studies too, that, you know, incredible number of scholarly books here, you know, good translations, grammatical studies, and so on. But I think it entirely distorts the field to stop with that. And also to kind of cover up and not talk about the differences between how, you know, traditional Indian scholarship, traditional Western scholarship, and who are you as a scholar. I think if we don't talk about those questions, then they just get out of hand and bad feeling comes in and so on. Yes.
Okay.
I must compliment you for your study of this text which you have referred. I have not read the text. I am not a Sri Vaishnava. But still I have two questions as a Sanskritist.
Please.
The first question was regarding the notion of Shabda. So I think for a Sanskritist, the notion of Shabda is that which is heard orally. So it's not that the printed version of the word is not taken into account, but the very basic notion of Shabda originates from whatever is heard.
Mm.
So that is why this emphasis on the oral tradition. And once you are oriented like that, it's difficult. As you said, whatever tradition you are born in, you are oriented in, it has impact.
Mm.
The second question is regarding the last point. You are writing a Christian commentary on the three holy mantras. I would not agree with this term commentary, because you see, the Sanskrit tradition, we have a very different connotation for the word commentary. Even if I write a translation of a Sanskrit text in Hindi or in any of the vernacular Indian languages, it will not be a commentary. It will be a translation, because the commentary has to be in the same language in which the text, original text, was written.
Okay.
I have an objection to this term.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like you have some very typical words like testament.
Yeah.
Anybody who writes on Bible, he cannot write a testament.
Mm.
Isn't it? Similarly, commentary. Any of the Indian versions of Ramayana, we have so many versions, but they are different versions.
Mm.
The Tamil version of Ramayana will not be a Tamil commentary of Ramayana.
Mm.
It has to be a different version.
Mm.
Because literally or traditionally, a commentary has to be in the same language in which the original text is written. So
well,
I think this word comment, if
you
are using it in the same sense,
tika,
we have many words, tika, vritti, vyakhya, bhashya, and all of them denote different shades of meaning.
Well, just to say two things quickly, and
First
of all, I'm very glad that you say this, because I'm not looking for agreement here. I'm looking for, scholarly viewpoints, and thank you for speaking. The first one, I think I largely agree with you about Shabda, and the hearing has to come first. I mean, even in the tradition, Shravana, Manana, the Shravana.
Shrotra, Grahana, Artha, Sa Shabda.
Yeah.
By definition, Shabda is that which is being heard.
But I think you could, and I'm not a historian, but I think even in the Mimamsa tradition, some of it seems to be easier to talk about as reading rather than simply hearing. That when you get into the, the complications of the exegesis of certain Vedic mantras and the ways of getting at meaning and so on, it seems to be a reading practice, not simply a hearing practice. But you're perfectly right. The shabda is original.
But for Mimamsakas, the case is different.
Okay.
Because no shabda is being produced anew or afresh.
Right.
It's eternal. So for them, it's a different case altogether.
Yeah. And then on the second one about the commentary in relation to the original language, two things I would say. One would be, again, I think Sri Vaishnavism is interesting in some way, because in a sense they're saying we can do this in two languages. And while other people may think that only Sanskrit can be used for explaining Sanskrit, Vedanta Deshika is using verses of the Alwars and so on to explain Gita text or Upanishadic text, and that they've liberated themselves from a Sanskrit
only. That's what the Manipravala style they have.
And then I don't know if they ever really thought about it enough to actually say a commentary must be in the language of the commented on text. I mean, is that said anywhere?
I haven't come across any commentary. For example, I say if I write, a Telugu person writes on any of the Sanskrit, it will not be called a commentary.
Okay. But is that just because it's always been that way, or because somebody has a rule to that effect?
I don't think there is a rule, but that is the convention.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, and
because we have definitions of these technical terms, so I haven't come across a tika written on a Sanskrit text in any other language.
And convention
that will be a critique, an interpretation, a translation, or whatever.
I mean, to tell you the truth, probably, except for this series of Christian commentaries and non-Christian texts, I probably wouldn't have used the word commentary. But now, because...
you may say a critique or an interpretation or whatever, but technically it won't be a commentary.
No, that's good.
For Sanskritists, at least.
I
have reservations about
That's good, thank you. Yeah,
it's like a convention.
Yeah.
The Hindus could start to the newer testament.
Yeah. newest testament. Yes.
Christians doing two commentaries and Hindus doing testaments.
Yeah. You had some.
It's just that from the little bit of knowledge I have about some of the Hindu texts, usually before the text starts, there is a
always a verse that says, who are the people who are eligible to read the text? What is going to be the benefit at the end? Now, since it always says who can read it, because there is a reason for saying who's the eligible student, the Sadhana Chatushtayam, who's the Adhikari, doesn't it color what you get out of the text if you don't fulfill the normal four other requirements? Because the purpose is said, this is the purpose why this text was written, for this purpose. And to read it out of that purpose, won't it actually color the...
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, it will definitely color it. Whether it will destroy it is less sure. I mean, the table back on the first page, I mean, the first part of Vedanta Deshika's text is the Guru Parampara Sara. And the whole thing is about any time you take up these things to talk about, you need to meditate on the lineage of gurus first. Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, not just that lineage, but how you are connected with it. So who your teacher was, whose teacher. And at the end of it, he has those instructions about how acharyas and shishyas should act. And again, that's where he says, you know, reading this in books is pointless. You need a teacher. So I think if somebody like me kind of intrudes on this and says, well, I've been reading Vedanta Deshika and reading the text he's been reading and reading 6-7 different commentaries of that tradition, okay, it still doesn't add up to being a member of, you know, to being at an acharya's feet and then reading in the expected way. But it's also not nothing. It's a partial engagement in the traditional reading. And partially because I said you can't avoid the spiritual meanings that come from this, a partial anticipation and embracing of the spiritual values that come from the reading. So it's neither a totally orthodox, traditional way of doing this, but it's also not something that's unrecognizable in relation to the values of the tradition.
Yeah, I accept that, but my point was saying that these texts were written for a specific purpose. It's almost like saying that you use a chisel for what it is meant for.
Yeah.
You can use it for something else. You can use it for chopping meat, but it is not going to be an efficient tool.
Yeah.
So this particular text is an instrument for that, and you're using it for something else.
Yeah.
So the value of the instrument and the validity of that instrument changes then. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, but even that is not entirely clear, because, I mean, I don't think he actually says in one sentence or two what it's for, but it's about increasing devotion, about total surrender to Sriman Narayana in Prapatti. It's about this total self-dedication to God. And that is not unrecognizable to the Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way in which this is a shared goal in some ways. Mm-hmm. Although some people could say, no, it's not alike at all. It's very different. Mm-hmm. And I realize it could be messed up. Kyo and then...
You mentioned in the lecture that the Vedanta Deshika himself says that it doesn't work if you just listen to teachers speaking from behind the wall. But on the other hand, you also mentioned as well, as you were saying, you can read the commentary, you can even maybe go to the Sri Vaishnava teacher without being initiated and then listen what he says about the text. So I have two questions. One is that according to the tradition that this tradition specified, what exactly you'll be missing if you don't take initiation or something like that. And also, my second question is that what you think you might be missing without being officially part of the tradition. So these two questions.
I mean, the first question is a good topic for real discussion. What difference does initiation make? And this comes up in different traditions in different ways. So, you know, I'm a Roman Catholic priest. I was ordained a priest. But I can imagine somebody who's not ordained a priest in the Catholic Church presiding at the Eucharistic, at the Mass, very ably and going and doing all the same things and preaching better, perhaps, etc. What is missing if you have not had the oil on your hands and the priest, the bishop's hands on your head and the invocation? That's a problem, because in some ways for the Catholic Church it's a radical difference. You know, this counts and that doesn't. And I think the same thing would be, you know, if you have not, what difference does it make if in fact I go to such and such acharya, and he's an interesting person because, in fact, he's read all these commentaries. Well, he's read them certainly better than I have, but it's not that I haven't read them at all. So, what, you know, do I really need to be there with the teacher? Is it simply that the teacher has read more than I've read, so has more kind of stored up here than I do? Or is there some kind of spiritual transmission? In some traditions, you know, about the Shakti Pat or something, I mean, there's a transmission of the Shakti. Yeah. But the Sri Vaishnavas don't quite say it that way. But what do I think I'm missing personally? I mean, what's the difference between being a full participant in a tradition and kind of hovering around its edges? I mean, I know very well what it means to be a Catholic.
If I may please interrupt.
Yeah, please.
It's not just a literary partnership or a partnership which you are trying to, you know, have established to another, within another tradition. If I understand it right, Guru Shishya Parampara is a hallmark of Indian wisdom traditions, whichever it is.
Yeah.
So it is not the teacher has read 10 commentaries. Okay, I also have read 9 commentaries, so it's not necessary I have to say. It's not exactly that, because it's not just a quantitative account of, you know, how many commentaries. It's something which is non-quantified, but at the same time of a qualitative level. I don't know how to express it, but I still feel Guru Shishya Parampara is a very strong hallmark of Indian Muslim traditions.
If I may compliment what you say, if I may just explicate in the terms of Mundaka Upanishad, there are two types of gurus actually. One is Shrotriya.
And
so the one you are referring to who has read many commentaries, he's just a Shrotriya. Yeah. He's a well-read person. But the real gurus were actually the Brahmanishthas, those who have perceived the reality. Unfortunately, maybe you or we have not found such gurus.
Yeah.
But actually that type of tradition of gurus or teachers who were able to transmit spiritually also, that is what is meant by these traditions.
But do you really think the first kind is just Shrotriya? I mean, that it's just book learning?
Yeah, if they have only read it, and if they have not actually absorbed it, and if they are not able to transmit it better than what you are reading.
But isn't it likely that if a person spends their life reading it, it's more than book learning? It must be a very odd pundit
if
it's had no effect on their
life.
I mean, maybe they weren't reading it properly.
No, I don't think. Can
then a university professor in the West be a Shrotriya? So if you have very learned...
He's a Shrotriya.
Who has no connection with tradition. He's not bent in the...
We also talk about people doing Upanishad Vyapara. Not necessarily Vyapara of intellectual as an economic activity.
And there may be Brahmanishthas who have not read a single word.
Yeah.
They are unlettered, but they are the real gurus, actually.
I guess
Keo, and then Gavin wants to get in. Keo, you're a fish here.
What I'm suggesting is that, well, even if one might be first Shrotriya as a Western academic, but if that kind of person contemplates it and meditates on it, it makes that as a part of himself or herself.
Yeah.
And isn't there some possibility that someone like that becomes closer to Brahmanishtha?
Why not?
Yeah.
There is no check on that.
So it's not really just one or the other.
No, it's not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Actually, it has to be both.
And I'm saying that if you read even from outside the tradition, you're not just one and not the other, because
it can
go from one.
Yeah, it can go. No? Yeah. If you have absorbed it, actually, that's what it means.
And to read for many years without absorbing it seems to take more effort than absorbing it.
Then depends. That is where comes the question which she raised in the beginning, that if someone is endowed with that aptitude, he may absorb it the very first day.
Yeah.
Also, you might be creating a third level of space, you know, where there is a possibility of transition.
Yeah, okay.
And at the same time, you are not fully into the tradition because you have not fully followed.
Right.
So, might be a third space, you can say that.
Somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle.
It's a kind of reading that you're identifying.
Transmitting from Shrotriya to
Brahmanishtha.
It's not Brahmanishtha. It's a sort of, you've identified something really important, it seems to me, Frank. One is a kind of religious reading that you've been describing, something very close to religious reading, which is the bringing to life in the present the voice of the text or the narrator of the text in the present moment for a community of reception, a particular kind of community of reception. That's one comment. And the second comment is that. That we're able to do that now. It's a kind of post-enlightenment method of reading that you're describing, which is going beyond a sort of scientism, if you like, and which is surely, which is dialogical, and is surely the way to move forward, really, in contemporary scholarship.
Yeah, no, I agree, really. Totally, yeah. Thank you. Anu?
Yeah, just this discussion, for me, it echoes a sort of a more foundational juxtaposition of two realities that are right there through all of the Hindu scriptures, particularly the Upanishads, the idea of, you know, social convention and the underlying reality. So on the one hand, yes, you are never going to be that learned Brahman, that initiated master of knowledge. And on the other hand, it's as you act, the fruits of your behavior, so shall you be. And this is, you know, it's been debated within the Hindu tradition, what does it mean to be a Brahman? Is it, and you have both. You must be born in the family, you must follow the ritualistic behaviors, the do's and the don'ts and the eating and all of this. And on the other hand, there's the other one who is a Brahman knows the truth of Brahman. Yeah. And on the one hand, I see what you're speaking about, this text. It's like, yes, there's levels of reading it. So on the one hand, there is the Christian tradition versus the Hindu tradition. And then on another level, there's a sort of a self-transformation of the self that you find in Francis de Sales, and perhaps you find a bit in Deshika. And ultimately, who's going to be the judge of that in the end anyway? So on the one hand, there's this, the social conventions that will be judged socially. And then on a deeper reality of Praman, of God, and the nature of the soul with the divine, well, who's there to judge that anyway, and who cares? But I mean, it's just both.
Well, I mean, it would follow from Gavin's comment, too. I mean, that this post-enlightenment reading would require different kinds of judgments, because the old traditional judgments may not work, and the enlightenment technical, indological judgments, let's say, may not work. So you need some other level of sophistication for sorting out when this works or doesn't work. Because I wouldn't want to leave it and say, well, no one can judge because this is all, you know, up to the person. But I think we should be able to say something about when is this done authentically or credibly or well, or when does it just seem to be the person's making it up or deluding themselves.
Yeah, you also have criteria of adequacy for a particular community of reception, which is developed historically and so on.
Like, I've the manuscript of this and both books, actually, I've given to several Sri Vaishnavas to read. And it would be distressing to me if people in the tradition were saying, you've totally missed it. You don't understand this. This is wrong. And I haven't gotten that reaction, but partially I would like at least to get some sense from within of whether this seems in some way to be on what level acceptable. Chris?
you were saying before, you were saying spiritual values, so presumably there must be some sort of ontological reality to, like, the Sri Vaishnava tradition. So my question is, in reference to when you were saying that one can't read a text and then draw a line and not be influenced by it, then to what extent philosophically can a Christian or a Catholic be influenced by sort of Vaishnavism in general? And I'm thinking, you know, specifically ontologically.
Well, it would seem, because both the Catholic and the Sri Vaishnava traditions believe that these things are true and real, that at some point the ontological issues have to be taken very seriously, and that these are claims about the way the world is and the way we are and the way God is. I think this is a special case because there's so much in common between Catholic theology and Sri Vaishnava theology. There are interesting points where they wouldn't be the same, but that at some point, I mean, maybe this is not what you mean, but I would say that at a certain point that a Catholic would have to affirm, well, in fact, the Sri Vaishnava got it right, and this is the way the world is, and that I'm better for recognizing that than denying it. Or were you thinking of points where they couldn't agree on that?
No, yes, specifically how they would agree, but when you say agree, could I ask you to explain that a little further?
So, like, I mean, it would be easy, and I haven't done this in these writings at all, but, you know, Om Namo Narayanaya, that, and Deshika in chapters, you know, 2 and 3, at least, very clearly about, you know, all things that exist are shesha. They exist for the Lord. They are dependent entirely. Their orientation, their ultimate reality is for Narayana. I can give you, you know, Christian texts from St. Augustine, from Ignatius Loyola, other people along the way. All things exist for God. All things are for the glory of God. To be is to be for God. And it would seem to be both traditions are making substantive claims about the truth of reality, and they actually are saying I'm always reluctant to say they're saying the same thing, but it seems that they're making claims that both can recognize. You know,
and presumably Vaishnavism, Sri Vaishnavism, couldn't do that unless Narayana was a name for God.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it would be hard to imagine a tradition that's right in the ontology and wrong in all the details. And people have said that in the past. Some of the missionary tradition is, you know, they have some deep basic right instinct, but it's just they have the wrong name of God, the wrong images, etc. Now, but there's always a way of getting off the hook, because in chapter 28, Vedanta Deshika 27 gives 108 meanings to the word Narayana, or 108 dimensions of its meaning. And probably like 106 of them any intelligent Christian could accept. Not the unintelligent Christians, but the intelligent ones could accept. And because they're not about Krishna with a flute or something. They're not. He seems to deliberately be avoiding or not taking up, you know, specific images that would be so rooted in the images that they would be unacceptable, but or unacceptable to the Christian, let's say. But that, you know, in terms of the qualities of God, the powers of God, the relation of God in the human, it would seem that a Christian could affirm, well, if this God's name is Narayana, I agree that, in fact, our God should be called Narayana too, if that's what you mean by Narayana.
And what about this Shri and Vai? Because if we go to Tattva and Purushartha, there could be agreement. But as far as the second one, Hita, the beneficial, Narayana and Shri, both are means to salvation. So how would you draw a parallel there? Because there are two.
Well, I'm coming, part of that's in my lecture tomorrow about that topic.
So point then on the advertising for the lecture tomorrow, we should stop really because we're supposed to stop at 3:30. So,
but let me just, can I answer it just briefly?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, basically, that, like Deshika says in chapter 28, that you really don't, in chapter 6, where he talks about the highest deity, the true meaning of deity, you don't understand Vishnu Narayana without taking Shri seriously. You can't do him without her. And then other Sri Vaishnavas argue that she has to be taken only as the Purushakara, the smaller reality, or slightly less. And he says, no, you have to take them both as entirely equal within the one divine reality. And that both is like a Trinitarian claim of Christians. This is one God in three persons. But it creates problems, because it's easy to talk about God, but to talk about he and she raises very great questions for Christians who don't think that way. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. I think Frank deserves a great round of applause for such an stimulating lecture that such a good discussion. So tomorrow is 5:00 is the Majewski lecture, in which Frank will be talking about his work on the Sri Vaishnava theologians and extending this further.
I mean, basically that comes down to chapter 23 of Rahasya Trayasara, the end of chapter 23, where he defends again what does Sriman mean? Sriman Narayana, and he has his own theory, and he's arguing with all the other acharyas and says, I have it right and you have it wrong. Mm-hmm.
So hope to see you all there. That's in the Oriental Institute tomorrow at 5.
Now I'm interested in reading Vedanta
tradition. Yeah, it's a great read. I think there's a translation of it here somewhere, because I left like a copy of it. The translation reads nicely.
Yeah, I mean, when I go to India next, I'll get the translation.
I think it's not. It hasn't been in print since. It's printed in 56. Okay.
Who was it printed by?
Agnihotra Murmanaja Tathacharya. It was this.